Hello, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Mario Cajar, and today I'll be reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. Up first, we have an article by Bob Harrig titled, "With a Remarkable Final Hole Par, Bryson DeChambeau Prevails on Wild U.S. Open." You could hear the celebratory chants and cheers from the other side of the Pinehurst Clubhouse, with Bryson DeChambeau barely having signed his scorecard with the U.S. Open trophy soon to be paraded around the premises, just pure jubilation. A matter of moments had passed since the winning putt dropped into the cup, with DeChambeau having produced one of the all-time pars from a greenside bunker to punctuate a stunning finish to a remarkable championship. And that's when Rory McIlroy and members of his team, including his agent and caddy, made a hasty departure, piling into a tournament-provided Lexus TX350. With McIlroy driving, the car backed out of its space and quickly sped out of the parking lot in hellish frustration. His private plane, via tracking site Radar Atlas 2, was in the air 53 minutes after DeChambeau's 18th green fist pumps. Even the TSA agents must have felt bad for him. As remarkable as DeChambeau's finish at Pinehurst No. 2 was to produce a second U.S. Open title, McIlroy's collapse was stunning. The tournament will undoubtedly be remembered as much for McIlroy's unraveling as it will be for DeChambeau's brilliance. McIlroy seemingly had a fifth major title in his grasp and certainly had a spot in a playoff locked up, but bogeyed three of the last four holes, including missed putts from 2 feet 6 inches at the 16th and 3 feet 9 inches at the 18th. That allowed DeChambeau, playing a group behind, to win with a par that was anything but routine, hitting a 55-yard bunker shot to inside of 4 feet and holing the winning putt. Here's what it sounded like.
Good contact.
And that's caught the slump, ran up there. Right below the hole goes DeChambeau, and he's pumped up.
McIlroy, understandably distraught, saw a chance for a first major title in 10 years vanish under the glaring heat of the final round drama, and there's simply no escaping the hard facts. He hadn't missed a putt inside of 3 feet all year, 496 of them, and hadn't missed inside 5 feet all week. He left just as quickly as it all unraveled. The question's to be answered another time. "Rory is one of the best to ever play," said DeChambeau. "Being able to fight against a great like that is pretty special. For him to miss that putt, I'd never wish that on anybody. It just happened to play out that way." He'll win multiple more major championships, there's no doubt. I think that fire in him is going to continue to grow. I have nothing but respect for how he plays the game of golf, because, to be honest, when he was climbing up the leaderboard, he was too ahead. I was like, uh-oh. But luckily, things went my way today. DeChambeau, who was classy in defeat last month when Xander Schofield beat him by a stroke at the PGA Championship, was just as much in victory to praise McIlroy, who actually may not ever get it done after the way this went down. The loss at St. Andrews to Cam Smith 2 years ago was tough, just as last year's U.S. Open defeat at the Los Angeles Country Club to Wyndham Clark stung. But McIlroy led by 2 strokes with 5 holes to play and couldn't close it out. Credit DeChambeau, whose resurgence in the last year has been nothing short of remarkable, from virtually no success at all on the LIV Golf Tour to now contending in 3 of the last 6 majors and winning one of them, is a remarkable turnaround. But he did not do it with his best stuff last Sunday. DeChambeau, for some reason, changed the head on his driver roughly 30 minutes prior to the final round. He admitted afterward he probably should not have done so. He hit just 5 of 14 fairways and just 11 of 18 greens. He made only 2 birdies and shot 1 over par 71, his highest score of the week. And when McIlroy got up and down from behind the 13th green for his 5th birdie of the day, he was 8 under par and leading by 2 shots. But DeChambeau matched that birdie on 13 and then appeared to make a fatal mistake with his first three-putt of the week at the 15th hole. McIlroy, however, showed the first sign of distress, missing from less than 3 feet at the 16th to fall back into a tie. Both players parred the 17th, and then McIlroy pulled his drive into the brush left of the 18th fairway. He had just 123 yards left, but appeared to have an awkward lie, the ball emerging low and running up short of the green, some 90 feet from the hole. He hit a nice chip shot to just under 4 feet and missed. It sounded like this.
Excruciating decade-long wait and excruciating short misses for McIlroy coming down the stretch. And DeChambeau coming back to 5-under means that a par for DeChambeau will win the second U.S. Open title.
It was a dramatic turn of events when a two-hole aggregate playoff seemed imminent. But DeChambeau had his own issues to deal with. He, too, found the area left of the fairway and sought relief from a rules official, believing a temporary immovable obstruction was in his way. But David Rickman, an RNA rules official who will serve as chief referee next month at Royal Troon, denied DeChambeau a drop. So he played into the right front bunker, and from there a bogey appeared inevitable. "It's really difficult," said Matthew Pavone, who played with DeChambeau and finished fifth, 3 shots back. "You can't really be long. But this is what I said to the guys. What's most important about Bryson is not that he hits the ball far. Everybody knows it. But I was amazed by the quality of the short game. It's master class. Short game on 8, up and down, was really, really clutch. He's a hell of a player. He has no weakness, and he's truly a great champion." Pavone, who was bidding to become the first player from France to win the U.S. Open, is rather new to the major championship scene. He got his first big victory last fall when he won the Spanish Open and earned a place on the PGA Tour through the DP World Tour. Earlier this year, he won the Farmers Insurance Open. That earned him a spot in the Masters, where he said he met DeChambeau for the first time. "And he was that guy. Super nice, super polite, that came to me and congratulated me for my win at Torrey," said Pavone. "This is the type of things you never forget, because for me, in the golf industry, I'm nobody. And when you have a major champion and a guy like him, very well known from everybody worldwide, when he just comes to you and has very simple words for this, it's really meaningful." Pavone was on the green and watched DeChambeau play that shot and openly cheered as he saw it roll up toward the hole. "I knew there was a decent chance that he could get a good look at it," said Greg Bodine, DeChambeau's caddy. "But still, it's a 55-yard bunker shot. It could come up short on the false front, and then you're staring double bogey in the face. If it goes long, you're looking at a 25-footer. But his short game is very underrated. I told people he's going to chip a lot. Obviously, you don't want a 50-yard bunker shot to get up and down to win the U.S. Open. But I wasn't shocked when he hit to 4 feet. DeChambeau has given a lot of credit to Bodine since coming on board just before the PGA Championship last year. The two had never worked together, but since then he finished fourth at the PGA, won twice with LIV, including shooting a 58 in the final round of the Greenbrier event, and now has 3 top 6 finishes in the major championships this year. The victory moved DeChambeau to 10th in the official world golf ranking, another impressive feat given the inability to earn any points at all playing for LIV. The win gives him another 10 years in the U.S. Open, as well as in the other 3 major championships through 2029. "That bunker shot was the shot of my life," said DeChambeau. "I'll be forever thankful that I've got longer wedges so I can hit it farther and get it up next to the hole," he said with a smile. "I don't know what to think. It hasn't fully sunk in yet. I just want everybody to enjoy it as well. As much as it is heartbreaking for some people, It was heartbreak for me at the PGA. I really wanted that one. When I turned the corner and saw I was a couple back, I said, nope, I'm not going to let that happen. I have to focus on figuring out how to make this happen. I was a little lucky, he said. Rory didn't make a couple putts that he could have coming in. I had an amazing up and down on the last. I don't know what else to say. It's a dream come true. For McIlroy, the nightmare endures. And now here's a follow-up to the previous story. It's by Madison Williams and it's titled, Rory McIlroy makes first comments since U.S. Open withdraws from PGA Tour event. The story of Rory McIlroy being just two putts short of winning the U.S. Open on Sunday has taken over the golf news cycle on Monday. The four-time major champion hasn't won a major championship since 2014, and this past weekend's U.S. Open at Pinehurst Course No. 2 was arguably the closest he's gotten since then. He missed two short putts on holes 16 and 18, both resulting in bogeys, and ended up losing by one stroke to Bryson DeChambeau. McIlroy's reaction to his loss quickly became a meme as he looked extremely disappointed. This past Monday afternoon, McIlroy made his first comments since the loss by posting a long message on social media about how he feels regarding what happened on Sunday, and I quote, "Yesterday was a tough day, probably the toughest I've had in my nearly 17 years as a professional golfer. As I reflect on my week, I'll rue a few things over the course of the tournament, mostly the two missed putts on 16 and 18 on the final day. But as I always try to do, I'll look at the positives of the week that far outweigh the negatives. As I said at the start of the tournament, I feel closer to winning my next major championship than I ever feel. The one word that I would describe my career as is resilient. I've shown my resilience over and over again in the last 17 years, and I will again. I'm going to take a few weeks away from the game to process everything and build myself back up for the defense of the Genesis Scottish Open and the Open at Royal Troon." End quote. McIlroy will also take a few weeks off from the PGA Tour, and as we know, he has withdrawn from this week's Travelers Championship in Hartford and prepare for the Genesis Scottish Open, which begins on July 11th, and the final major championship of the season, the Open Championship, on July 18th at Royal Troon. You're in tune with the Magazine Rack on Chris. Next up, we have two articles by Kristen Wong, both about Caitlin Clark. The first one is titled, Caitlin Clark Had the Perfect Answer About Her Feisty Matchups with Angel Reese. Indiana Fever rookie Caitlin Clark has been on the receiving end of a flagrant foul twice now when playing with the Chicago Sky, but that hasn't made her at all jaded about future matchups. After the Fever's 91-83 win over the Sky, Clark brushed off Sky forward Angel Reese's flagrant foul during Sunday's post-game press conference. "It's just a part of basketball," said Clark of Reese's foul in the third quarter. "Just trying to make a play on the ball and get the block. It happens." Clark was driving toward the basket for a layup when Reese swung her arm and hit Clark in the back of the head. Reese was assessed a flagrant one after official review. In light of her competitive history against Reese, Clark was asked why her matchups with the former LSU standout tend to draw so much attention, dating back to when Clark's Hawkeyes and Reese's Tigers set viewership records in the NCAA women's tournament. "I think it's just the emotion and the passion that we play with," said Clark. "I think people love to see that, and I think that's maybe not something that was always appreciated in women's sports, and it should be. Hey, we're competitors. That's the way the game should be. It's going to get a little feisty, it's going to get a little physical, but at the end of the day, both teams are just trying to win." Clark continued to heap praise on Reese, calling her a tremendous player and praising her for what she's done with her platform in recent years. In two WNBA matchups, Clark is 2-0 against Reese, and the two will suit up for another showdown next Sunday in Chicago. It's been fun getting to compete against her, said Clark. I think it's really been good for the game. People just love seeing great matchups. And now here's the second article by Kristen Wong. It's titled, Angel Reese Bluntly Addresses Flagrant Foul on Caitlin Clark in Sky's Loss to the Fever. It didn't take long for Chicago Sky rookie Angel Reese to field her first question about her foul on Caitlin Clark in Sunday's post-game press conference. Following the Sky's 91-83 loss to the Indiana Fever at Gainbridge Fieldhouse, Reese was asked about her foul on Clark, which was upgraded to a flagrant one after official review. It was a basketball play, said Reese, via the Athletics' Nicole Auerbach. I can't control the refs. They affected the game obviously a lot today. I'm always going for the ball. Y'all are going to play that clip 20 times before Monday. Reese committed the flagrant foul while Clark was driving to the rim in the third quarter. The Sky rookie swung her arm and hit the back of Clark's head, sending Clark sprawling to the floor. Reese was assessed a flagrant one for unnecessary contact per the WNBA's rulebook. A flagrant two foul would be considered unnecessary as well as excessive. Reese finished with a sixth straight double-double, 11 points and 13 rebounds, while shooting 30.8% from the field. Clark finished with 23 points on 7 of 11 shooting, adding 8 rebounds and 9 assists to set yet another historical record. The last time the Sky and Fever met was on June the 1st, when Sky's Chenity Carter stirred up controversy for her hard foul on Clark in the Fever's 71-70 win. The two teams will meet again next Sunday, June 23rd, at Wintrust Arena in Chicago. You're listening to the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now here's an article by Pat Ford titled, The U.S. Olympic Swim Trials Produced a Torchbearer for Every Middle-Aged Athlete. This past Sunday morning, Father's Day, Matthew Rose knew where he needed to be. He drove by himself to his father's grave in Aspen, Colorado, pulled out his phone, and watched his younger sister, Gabrielle, defy age and time, accompanied by the memory of Michael Rose. I was with Dad, says Matthew. Gabby, age 46 and competing in the U.S. Olympic swimming trials for the first time since 2004, swam a lifetime best of 108.43 in the 100-meter breaststroke. The oldest of more than 1,000 athletes swimming at Lucas Oil Stadium became the oldest semifinalist in U.S. trials history, delighting a crowd of 17,697 with a shocking display that turned a young person's sport upside down. Here's what it sounded like.
Worth pointing out, lane number 5 is officially the oldest swimmer here. She's in the lead. Gabby Rose is 46 years young and absolutely blowing it out of the water right now. 31.7 on her opening 50 meters for Rose. Her lifetime best came actually last year, so getting better and better as time goes on. She's got a battle now from Zoe Skirball of Racer X Aquatics and the University of Virginia. Skirball was out in a 32.55 under her PR pace. But Gabby Rose, at 46 years young, is going to win the heat and post our top time at a 108.43 as we get ready for the final three heats. What an incredible swim from Gabby Rose.
Michael Rose, former president of Holiday Inns Incorporated, who died of cancer in 2017, would have adored this surprise chapter in his daughter's life. She was a two-time Olympian a lifetime ago and somehow conjured up some of her old greatness. He would have gotten a total kick out of this, says Matthew Rose. He supported us and encouraged us in everything we did. Sunday night, after Gabby swam yet another lifetime best of 108.32 to finish 10th, not quite fast enough to make the eight-woman final, her proud smile mingled with a rush of emotion. She was thrilled to have her 9-year-old daughter, Annie, watching in the stands. but she missed who wasn't there. Father's Day, she noted, voice breaking and tears welling up. Yeah, he would have loved all of this. Gabby has carried on Mike Rose's vision and passion with the Rose Foundation, which has invested in athletic facilities and educational opportunities in the family's hometown of Memphis, Tennessee, especially aimed at benefiting at-risk populations in the city. After making the 1996 and 2000 Olympics and competing at trials in 2004, high-level competitive swimming gradually became a side gig. Living in Southern California, Gabby always stayed in superb shape, but went in and out of swimming at the Masters level, age group races. She coaches at Alpha Aquatics, but had a breakthrough performance at Masters Nationals last spring, posting a lifetime best in the 100 breaststroke. Given the calendar, with 2024 being an Olympic year, that triggered this midlife dream. As she posted faster and faster times, she passed them along to Matthew, who is an elite-level triathlon coach with Dynamo Multisport in Atlanta. He suspected something was up. One Tuesday last July, after teaching a cycling class, Matthew asked Dynamo's head swim coach, Jan Murray, what the breaststroke Olympic trials qualifying times were. Gabby's times were on track. "I think my sister is trying to make trials," he said. He called Gabby and asked, "Are you trying to make trials?" "Yeah," she said sheepishly, "I really want to make it." And so she did, but in a stroke that she had fallen out of touch with more than 30 years ago. Gabby was a national age group record holder in the 50 and 100 breaststroke at age 12. But as often happens with breaststrokers, things can change. Rhythm and tempo can disappear. Body changes can disrupt the stroke. She changed her emphases to individual medley, butterfly, and freestyle, becoming an NCAA champion at Stanford and an Olympian for two nations. First, utilizing her dual citizenship to make the Brazilian team in 1996, and then the U.S. team in 2000. When her breaststroke came back to her, she was ready to excel with newfound gifts of wisdom and perspective. "I'm kind of going back to that little girl who was disappointed and didn't get to pursue that and wondered what happened to her breaststroke. I found it just a couple decades later," she said. On the eve of this improbable Olympic trials, Matthew sent her a long email last Friday. He reminded her of her long and occasionally complex relationship with the sport, with swimming, with water itself. "The water's been patient with her," he says. "This has been a long, non-linear journey. To go after something when you've got the wisdom and so much perspective, she can do this without the weight on her shoulders of any expectations. This is the happiest I've seen her in a long time." Never a threat to make the Olympic team, which only takes the top two qualifiers in each individual event, she was thrilled to be an exemplar of what is possible at an age when so many people aren't even trying to do something great athletically. "I'm really lucky to feel so young and strong," she said. "I don't really relate to the oldest. I'm hoping to show people you can do more, you can have more energy, you can have more strength than you thought possible. I want women in particular to not be afraid to be strong, to lift weights, to take care of themselves." Gabby quickly became a fan favorite in Indy, getting enthusiastic ovations even when she was sharing the pool with home state favorite and world record holder Lily King. Making the semifinals was a revelation. Nearly making the finals was the last celebration of something improbable, something Michael Rose would have absolutely loved. "This was the cherry on top," she said on Sunday night. "Hearing the crowd, it was really, really a great experience. So many people have reached out. It's been a special feeling to be embraced by so many. I'm so proud of myself." This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. Now here's a piece by Kristen Wong titled, "Tom Brady Joins Fox Sports Booth for the First Time During UFL Championship." Former NFL quarterback Tom Brady entered the Fox Sports booth for the first time during last Sunday's UFL championship game between the Birmingham Stallions and San Antonio Brahmas. The 46-year-old Brady signed a 10-year, $375 million contract with Fox Sports to become the lead game analyst starting in the 2024-25 season, replacing longtime play-by-play announcer Greg Olsen. Though he won't begin his analyst gig until this coming fall, Brady got his toes wet on Sunday night as he was reportedly slated to call plays in the second quarter of the UFL championship. Fellow Fox announcers Kurt Menefee and Joel Klatt happily welcomed Brady to the booth.
Tom Brady, legendary quarterback, just had his number retired.
I can't go down there on the field anymore.
You can't play anymore?
No.
He's joining us here at Fox Sports. I'm sure you have heard as an analyst this fall. Can't wait to see him. So far, what are your impressions of this early going? Championship game, sometimes teams can be a little bit tight. It looks like it may be right here.
They're all a little different. Yeah. You get into these games, and there's a lot of defense out there right now. You see defense can go out there and play with a lot of energy, but someone's got to get the ball down the field to open this field up a little bit. It's a lot of horizontal passes, and the defenders are swarming and trying to punch the ball out. So make them defend every blade of grass. That's what we said.
Brady's number 12 jersey was retired by the New England Patriots last week during the seven-time Super Bowl winners' Hall of Fame induction in Foxborough. This is the Magazine Rack on Chris. And finally, following the Tom Brady article, here's the other side of the coin by Stephen Douglas, titled, Charles Barkley Announces Plans to Retire from Broadcasting After 2024-25 Season. Charles Barkley shocked the basketball world Friday night by announcing his plans to retire from broadcasting during an on-air appearance on NBA TV following Game 4 of the NBA Finals. Looking into the NBA TV cameras, Barkley said he plans to retire after the 2024-25 NBA season, the final year that TNT currently holds rights to broadcast NBA games. The 61-year-old, who has been making constant jokes about being unemployed next year, also said he has entertained offers from other networks but doesn't want to work anywhere else besides TNT. I just want to say thank you to my entire NBA family, said Barkley. I love you guys. You know, there's been a lot of noise around our network the last few months, and I just wanted to say I've talked to all the other networks, but I ain't going anywhere but TNT. But I have made the decision myself. No matter what happens, next year is going to be my last year on television. The partnership between TNT and the NBA began in 1989, but it appears that it's coming to a close after the next season now that ESPN, NBC, and Amazon have emerged as the favorites to take over the broadcast rights. Barkley has been an analyst covering the NBA on TNT since 2000. Alongside Kenny Smith, Shaquille O'Neal, and Ernie Johnson, Barkley helped make Inside the NBA arguably the most beloved sports show in TV history. I just want to say thank you to my NBA family, said Barkley. You guys have been great to me. My heart is full with joy and gratitude, but I'm going to pass the baton at the end of next year. I'm going to pass the baton to either Jamal Crawford or Vince Carter or you, Steve Smith. But next year, I'm going to just retire after 25 years, and I just wanted to say thank you, and I wanted y'all to hear it from me first. And that'll do it for this installment of the Magazine Rack on Chris. I've been reading from the Sports Illustrated website, SI.com. I'm Mario Cajar. So long, till next time.